Aperture.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
Old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It's like answers, really, just to someone that can rest, and I can rest, and my family can rest, and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. Next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look epidemiologically and clinically at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
That's work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
person was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums and their swags and everything. They used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any work day. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head sharanks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes. Everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know.
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white, or bleached white, where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see
the doctor?
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than it used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to their normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil and or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me? You know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kin Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, not the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yeah.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
Getting a rash on there too. It's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. You put my shirt down now.
Mm. No mother wants to watch your son deteriorate like this, and it's something that can't fix, you know? Can't kiss it better, can't put a Band-Aid on it, and I've just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than 3 decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happened, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities?
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
While 2020 will be remembered for the global coronavirus pandemic, it also will go down as a year marked by resurgent criminal violence that may end up spelling serious trouble for American cities, says Raphael A. Mangel, writer in an article titled U.S. Cities Got Deadlier in 2020. Stay tuned for the details, please. For those who follow urban American history, the most remarkable story of the 20th century's last decade has to be what's now widely known as the Great Crime Decline. Why 2020 most assuredly will be remembered for the global coronavirus pandemic, it also will go down as a year marked by resurgent criminal violence that may end up spelling serious trouble for American cities, especially if they botch their responses to it. In 1991, the U.S. saw almost 25,000 homicides, a rate of 9.8 per 100,000. The country's deadly crime problem was then, as it is now, heavily concentrated in cities. New York City alone accounted for almost 10% of all homicides in 1991. Chicago, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. together accounted for another 10%. Representing one of the greatest victories by the turn of the century, annual homicides were down by more than 9,000, a decline concentrated heavily in and around America's urban centers, though the final numbers won't be available for months. Criminologists estimate that 2020 will have seen, for the first time since mid-1990s, more than 20,000 criminal homicides. Once again, a sizable portion of the 2020 spike occurred in urban jurisdictions, big, medium, and small. New York, which also had seen homicides rise, In 2018 and 2019 saw almost 150 additional homicides and more than 750 additional shootings in 2020, representing respective increases of 45% and 97%. Chicago, which hadn't yet fully recovered from homicide spikes in 2015 and 16, saw 274 more homicides and 1,435 additional shootings in 2020, 55% spikes. LA saw homicides jump approximately 38%, or nearly 100, while shootings spiked almost 40%. DC closed 2020 with homicides up for the third year, this time by almost 20%, or 32 more deaths. Killings in Philadelphia, where year-end homicides have risen every year since 2016, were just one body shy of 500, a 40% increase. Louisville saw homicides jump by more than 70%, shattering a record set in 2016. And also, there are other numbers. The 66 cities that responded to the Major City Chiefs Association's year-end violent crime survey collectively saw 1,990 more murders in 2020 than in 2019, which is almost half of the 4,000 additional murders experts have estimated occurred in 2020. What should cities do about this? The answer depends on how they view the problem. In the wake of last year's increasing murders, some commentators expressed concern about what looked like the makings of an extended violent crime wave. Others have struck a more calming note, reminding the public that despite the increase, the U.S. is still faring much better than it was in the bad old days of the early 1990s. This is true strictly speaking, but it's not a particularly helpful observation for a couple of reasons. First, in many cities, homicide numbers actually have neared or surpassed their early 1990s peaks. Second, murders and shootings generally are hyper-concentrated at the micro-geographic level, and the national murder rate doesn't paint anything close to an accurate picture of how safe or unsafe those places are. Why some are not yet willing to sound the alarm likely stems from the uncertainty regarding the cause of what seems like a widely distributed uptick in lethal criminal violence. There is a sharp disagreement about what might be driving homicide upward, one that in many ways mirrors the ongoing debate about what was behind the great crime decline. Some experts have argued that the spike is a temporary side effect of the pandemic brought on by its economic impact, particularly with respect to unemployment. But this is in tension with the broader data on violent crimes such as homicides and economic indicators, which does not reveal a clear relationship between the two. In New York, for example, the poverty rate in 1989, the year before homicides hit a record high, 2,262, was actually slightly lower than it was in 2016, the year before Big Apple homicides hit a record low, 292. And during the Great Recession, the national homicide rate actually declined by 15%, going from 5.7 per 100,000 in 2007 to 4.8 per 100,000 in 2010, a period in which the civilian unemployment rate rose from 4.6 to 9.3%. The pandemic explanation also is complicated by the fact that the homicide spikes across the U.S. has been driven by a much narrower slice of the population than has been impacted by the pandemic. Perhaps what we see in 2020 and in many cities continue to see through the first quarter of 2021 has more to do with a combination of factors related to policing and criminal justice.
The World with Reporters.
Iranian lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, meets the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Mariano Grossi. The legal and technical discussions taking place in Vienna as part of the Joint Commission meeting focused on U.S. sanctions that need to be removed and nuclear measures that need to be taken by Iran in order for the country to come back to full compliance with the nuclear agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Araghchi said if the talks come to a conclusion, the agency is going to have a very important role in verifying Iran's activities. But a conclusion is not to be expected anytime soon.
We are still far from getting to a concrete conclusion, but I can say that we are progressing well.
Araghchi stressed that Iran is against a step-by-step approach and will only take action once the U.S. removes all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA under former President Donald Trump.
The U.S. should lift its sanctions first, and that should be done in one step, and then we verify, and after verification, we do our part of the job. We go back to full compliance.
How Iran verifies the U.S. measures, how long it will take, and also how long it will take for Iran to come back to full compliance are all issues that are going to be negotiated in the coming days. The Joint Commission will meet again on Friday to review the work of the expert groups. Delegations will leave Vienna for a 2 to 3 day break before returning to continue negotiations. Homolezki, Vienna.
Turkey has reported an unprecedented surge of daily coronavirus cases. The new infections stood at almost 55,000 on Wednesday, as the highest in the country since the outbreak of the pandemic last year. Turkish government plans to reduce the numbers during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan to welcome tourists again after the month. Turkish president said that he wants to see a significant reduction in the number of coronavirus infections by the end of Ramadan, as he announced last week that during the holy month, restaurants and coffee shops' work will be limited to takeout and delivery services only. Meanwhile, Turkey will continue to witness a daily curfew from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. and total weekend lockdowns.
We aim to give a rest to our country during Ramadan and prepare it for better days after the Eid. If we could decrease the number of the cases to thousands, we will be able to catch the tourism season that is understood to be opened in May and the commercial activity that will be created by the tourism season.
Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca said earlier that 75% of the new coronavirus cases in the country are from the more contagious variant detected in Britain. This as the country is still open for tourists who are not included in the curfew and lockdown measures. Some analysts believe the latest measures is the reason behind the sudden increase in the new cases.
We expected to see a spread of the virus amid the third wave. However, we didn't expect to see such high numbers, especially after we began public vaccination. Turkish government's trying to create a balance between people's health and economy. That's why it's trying to implement measures to contain the spread of the virus until at least 60% of the country is vaccinated.
Turkey is pressing ahead with its nationwide vaccination campaign using the Sinovac and Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine shots. So far, more than 10.55 million people have been given the first doses, and 7.41 million were given the second. Turkey's announcement of a nationwide lockdown during the holy month of Ramadan has created chaos, which is seen by many as the reason behind the increasing number of daily infections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Since Joe Biden took office in the U.S., relations between Washington and Moscow have only spiraled downwards. The Biden administration has signaled a more confrontational approach towards Russia. It has already hit Moscow with economic sanctions over the jailing of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Washington has also threatened unspecified action over an alleged massive cyber attack, which it blames on Russia. Tensions have risen particularly after Biden publicly stated that he thinks Putin is a killer. Now, the Russian government says it will respond in kind to any new U.S. sanctions amid reports that the White House is about to announce further bans against Russia. This time, the source of tensions is the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Over the past 2 weeks, mainstream Western media outlets have been reporting about an increase in Russia's military presence along its borders with Ukraine. This coincides with reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, leaving a ceasefire in the region effectively dead. Ukraine, the US and NATO accused Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in the region. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. Analysts believe Russia's military buildup along the border with Ukraine is a response to Kiev's saber-rattling.
This buildup of Russian troops is actually, to the contrary, it is in response to saber-rattling by Ukraine that is being instigated by the United States and in the form of NATO.
The notion that Russia is responding to Ukraine's escalation does not seem far from reality. Some observers believe Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is in a weak position at home, is playing the anti-Russian card to appease the nationalist population and mobilize support in the West. They cite a recent crackdown on pro-Russia media and figures, as well as Zelensky's public call on NATO to speed up Ukraine's membership plan. The Kremlin, which has repeatedly voiced concern over NATO's eastward expansion, bitterly opposes the notion that Ukraine could someday join the Western military alliance. After all, Biden has been one of Kiev's staunchest supporters since before the outbreak of the conflict in eastern Ukraine in 2014. This week, Biden himself pledged unwavering support to the Ukrainian government. It remains to be seen how far the new U.S. administration is ready to go in its confrontational path on Russia. If the current trajectory continues, soon we will see a full-scale war of sanctions between the two governments at the least.
World Health Day is celebrated on the 7th of April every year. For 2021, the theme is Building a Fair, Healthier World. For Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, health inequities are an everyday reality that is rooted in Israel's long-held apartheid regime. Tel Aviv has waged three wars on the blockaded enclave and maintains a crippling blockade on it since 2007. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces attacked 17 hospitals and 56 health centers. The Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for health workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place over the past 14 years has battered the entire health system in the Gaza Strip. Hospitals and medical centers suffer from acute shortages in medicines and medical equipment, especially amid the rapid spread of the coronavirus pandemic.
This year's World Health Day comes amid a surge in coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip. Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the impoverished enclave, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
On this day, we confirmed that the epidemiological situation in the Gaza Strip is very dangerous, and the curve of infections continues to increase. Everyone must take the necessary measures to safeguard their families. We also call on all concerned local and international parties to help us in fighting the pandemic.
Under international laws and norms, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. Experts warn that the health sector in Gaza could soon collapse unless serious steps are made to remedy the situation.
On World Health Day, the regime's blockade continues to undermine efforts by health workers in Gaza to provide proper medical care. This is while the situation has worsened in the besieged enclave due to the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanar, Gaza.
Around 45% of Italian firms involved in productive sectors are structurally at risk. This is one of the major findings of a new report on the competitiveness of productive sectors in Italy, released by the Bureau of Statistics Istat on Wednesday. The report warns that firms operating mostly in sectors of low technological and knowledge content would not be able to survive to a further external crisis.
The situation wasn't very much different before the COVID crisis. Italian firms were already suffering from their usual weaknesses. If these firms don't receive financial aid in the coming 3 to 4 months, they will drown. Non-food activities are suffering the most.
A series of national lockdowns to safeguard Italy's population from COVID-19 and the collapse of the health system have resulted in an economic disaster. According to the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, about 390,000 businesses shut their doors in Italy last year.
The Istat report has found tourism, arts and entertainment, and catering are among the productive sectors that have suffered with great intensity from the impact of the containment measures adopted by the Italian authorities so far.
Take out food and delivery orders once at my restaurant. That's all we've been allowed to do for months. Either we reopen in full or we die. We've got bills to pay.
I'm not surprised people have not yet taken to the streets to stage a revolution. I'm lucky to have my pension payments. Many, including my son, are jobless. Many went bankrupt.
Meanwhile, Italy has been swept by protests from north to south over the past days. Hospitality operators, restaurant owners, shopkeepers, street market traders are calling for reopenings as a second round of government economic support measures has been delayed. Max Civili, Rome.
Yemenis in the capital Sana'a have marched on the United Nations office in the city to slam the international community's silence in the face of Saudi's illegal acts. The protesters called for international action amid the continued detention of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition.
Today we have completed 2 years of protests in front of the United Nations office. We organized 730 protests to denounce the continued piracy against fuel ships. We have a 1,400-meter-long letter of condemnation signed by the Yemenis. The United Nations and the U.S. are directly observing the detention of oil vessels, and they bear responsibility for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
The protesters slammed the U.S. as a key partner in exacerbating the suffering of millions of Yemenis. They said Saudi Arabia's U.S.-backed siege on Yemen has caused a severe shortage of basics, including fuel, food and water, leading to numerous deaths, including among children.
Public sector employees are protesting today in front of the United Nations office because the UN bears the moral and humanitarian responsibility regarding the continued detention of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition as it happens under the direct supervision of the UN.
Since the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade in Yemen, depriving millions of civilians of their necessities and even hampering the humanitarian aid in the war-torn country. This has pushed the country to the brink of famine and has wrecked the healthcare system.
For 2 years now, Yemenis have been protesting outside the United Nations office in Sana'a with no tangible results. However, they say their army is now capable of forcing Saudi Arabia into listening to their voices and lift the blockade it imposed on their country. Sana'a.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining participants of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. The sides have set up two expert-level working groups that are going to come up with two lists. one of sanctions to be lifted by the United States and the other of nuclear measures to be undertaken by Iran in order for the country to return to full compliance with the nuclear agreement. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says that Tehran is not interested in any step-by-step return to the deal and is demanding the full removal of sanctions imposed, reimposed or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA.
I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. And after verification, we certainly go back to full compliance.
Iran says it has not and will not engage in any direct or indirect talks with the U.S., and it would be up to the other JCPOA signatories, namely Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia, to talk to the Americans. The Joint Commission will meet again in Vienna on Friday to review the work of the expert groups and discuss sequence and timing. But if there's a lack of progress, Tehran says, it will end the talks. We are not in a hurry, says Iran's lead delegate. Homolezki, Vienna.
This racist, Islamophobic, misogynistic.
The daughter of a Muslim who was murdered by a white supremacist as he walked home from his local mosque has launched a campaign demanding the UK government finally adopt an Islamophobia definition. Maz Salim, whose father, Mohammed Salim, was killed by a neo-Nazi terrorist 8 years ago, has launched the campaign to highlight Islamophobic hate crimes and force the definition back on the government's agenda.
Pablo Lapkin was charged under terrorism laws. It's been 8 years now. I've been tirelessly campaigning against racism and Islamophobia. And still today, my father's name is not being mentioned in the mainstream media as an act of terrorism. And I think that's really important because whenever a Muslim is a victim, the media is very biased in the way it reports it. It's always such as lone wolf or mosque bomber. Or murderer. No, he was actually, quite frankly, a terrorist, so I want that to be highlighted. That's extremely important.
The campaign includes an online hashtag, I am Mohammed Salim, which others can use to post testimonies exposing how dangerous Islamophobia is becoming.
I've already been inundated with a lot of videos, a lot of footage, which I'm going to release every single day. And if you already look on our Twitter and our Instagram, you can see already people speaking about their experience of racism, Islamophobia and xenophobia. So if you continue to send us these videos, then we can put pressure on the government as to what is exactly happening on our streets today.
Sadly, Mohammed Salim is not the only victim. In 2015, 81-year-old Mohsin Ahmed was killed by two men in a racially motivated attack in Rotherham. And in 2017, Makram Ali was killed during the Finsbury Park terror attack during the holy month of Ramadan. In 2018, an all-party parliamentary group issued a report on anti-Muslim prejudice, which urged the government to define Islamophobia. So far, the government has refused to do so.
Islamophobic attacks and racist verbal abuse are becoming near normalised here in Britain, with many Muslims complaining that it's become basically a daily occurrence. But if the government continues to refuse to acknowledge that Islamophobia is a very real and vicious form of hate crime, then preventing future attacks and also providing justice to victims will continue to get all the more harder. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian children continue to suffer due to Israel's inhumane practices as they mark Palestinian Child Day. Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinian children over the past decade under the watchful eye of the international community. Last year alone, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinian children. During a press conference marking the annual event, Palestinians demanded that Israeli forces be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian children.
Israeli soldiers are acting with impunity because they feel that they will not be prosecuted for their crimes. Such policies have encouraged Israeli soldiers to violate our rights. The international community must take concrete steps to prosecute those Israeli soldiers who kill and maim us on a daily basis.
Scores of Palestinian children lost their lives during the Great March of Return peaceful rallies due to Israel's use of excessive force against peaceful protesters. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinian children were systematic.
As we mark Palestinian Child Day, Israel continues to commit grave violations against Palestinian children, including wounding them and killing them. Israel also violates the social, economic, and cultural rights. The Israeli blockade has negatively affected all aspects of life for Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip.
Since 2008, the Israeli regime waged three wars on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming thousands of children. During Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including hundreds of children.
The Zionist enemy violates the rights of Palestinian children to live. They have bombed the homes where Palestinian children live and have deprived them from receiving proper education and health care. Palestinian children are even deprived from the right of movement.
Palestinian Child Day highlights the ongoing plight of those born under Israeli occupation and blockade.
Human rights groups have long accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting Palestinian children. This comes amid the failure of the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Recently, a group of child rights experts have strongly criticized the UN Secretary General for excluding eight parties, including the Israeli regime and the Saudi-led coalition, from a global blacklist of parties accountable for harming children during conflicts. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Alan Rock, who was Canada's ambassador to the UN from 2003 to 2006 and served as a UN special advisor on children and armed conflict in Sri Lanka, titled UN Should Stop Playing Politics with Children's Lives. The article was published by the Al Jazeera website. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Children around the world suffer the consequences of war. They're routinely killed, maimed, recruited to fight, and otherwise abused. In 2020, the United Nations reported more than 25,000 such grave violations in the previous year. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has powerful tools at his disposal to pressure those responsible to end such abuses, but he is failing to use them, often placing politics above children's lives. Over the past 20 years, The UN Security Council has put in place a framework to protect children in conflict zones. It requires the Secretary General to report every year on grave violations against children, including killing and maiming, recruiting child soldiers, sexual violence, and bombing schools. The Secretary General is required to attach a list of those responsible to his report. The list of shame, as it is sometimes called, is the linchpin for holding parties accountable for grave violations. When used as intended, the list has been a remarkably effective tool. Governments and non-state armed actors alike dread the stigma of being listed and are motivated to engage with the UN on steps they can take to end their abuses and be removed from the list. Rock wrote, "I have seen for myself the power of the list. In 2006, I served as a UN Special Advisor on Children and Armed Conflict in Sri Lanka, where I met with dozens of heartbroken families whose children had been abducted by the Tamil Tigers or the government-linked Tamil Makal Pulkal, that is TMVP, and forced to fight in Sri Lanka's civil war. The TMVP was added to the list of shame in 2006. Following intensive dialogue with the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, it signed and implemented an action plan to end the abductions, and it was removed from the list in 2011. Rock said, "At that time, there was a palpable sense of optimism among those of us working to protect children in armed conflicts. We saw the Secretary General's list as a strong instrument to root out practices like recruiting child soldiers. And for many years it was. In addition to the TMVP in Sri Lanka, the list shamed many others into changing their ways. Among them, the Maoists in Nepal, government forces in Chad, Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sudan. However, in recent years, decisions about listing have become increasingly politicized, undermining the list's potential to protect children. For example, in 2016, the UN's then Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, removed the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen from his list. Even though coalition airstrikes massacred more than 450 children and injured hundreds the previous year. The reason? Saudi threats to withdraw UN funding. Although Secretary General Guterres returned the Saudi coalition to his list in 2017, he removed it again in 2020, despite the UN's own findings that the coalition was responsible for at least 222 child casualties the previous year. Guterres has also removed the Myanmar Armed Forces, the Tatmadaw, from the list for recruiting and using children, despite hundreds of documented violations in 2019 and 2020. Noted, these betrayals prompted me to join a group of international children's rights experts to conduct a systematic review of the Secretary General's listing and delisting decisions over the past decade and to make recommendations to end the politicization of this process. The author of this article said, "The extent of the discrepancies we found was shocking. There is a clear mismatch between information about violations documented by the UN itself and the groups and government forces on the list. Our review identified dozens of cases in which multiple violations did not lead to listing or in which listing decisions reflected unexplained inconsistencies." Rock continued, "Our analysis also found that government forces